Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have an amazing founder. You know, we're going to be talking about building, scaling, financing. You know, in their case, they've raised $100 million. They have about 60 employees and they're doing some really good stuff in the AI space. But again, you know, brace yourself for impact because this one is going to be inspiring. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Gaurav Misra. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
So originally you were born in the US, but then at 4, you know, you're assault, it sounds like your parents wanted to pack the bags to go to Delhi. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like at 4, I don't even remember being in the US, right? Like my earliest memories are actually in India. And if my parents hadn't told me, I wouldn't even know that I was actually born in the US. But it was one of the most important things that probably happened to me just because the birth of my citizenship, I was able to get citizenship from the beginning. Able to come back later on, helped me quite a bit. And I think for my parents, it was a matter of my dad was doing his PhD in the US. He completed his PhD and they wanted to head back to India, you know, be with family and stuff. So it made a ton of sense.
So then tell us about how did you get into the whole computer thing?
Yeah, honestly, it's something I was interested in from the very beginning. And, you know, even from the early ages, like I was programming maybe when I was like, you know, 8, 10 years old. Really excited about, you know, me and my brother used to play a lot of games. So we would like start getting into making games, programming games, things like that. And that got me like pretty far along in terms of like learning how to be good at, you know, just making brand new things, you know, making things that I can, you know, show my friends. They kind of like it. They're like, wow, that's cool. I can play this game. And that gave me a lot of joy, you know, just like kind of seeing things that I made, showing it to people, and they appreciate it. And in India, the culture is a little bit more tilted towards sort of computer science from the beginning, like as opposed to the US. Like in India, it's taught right from the beginning, right? I think even in like first, second, third grade, you're already getting into programming on the computer. And by the time you get to, you know, 12th grade, you're doing like college level and beyond, essentially. So there's almost like a culture of like, you know, getting kids more involved in computers from the beginning.
So then in your case, why did you decide to come to the US? Obviously, I know that you came to Boston University, but there's great universities in India.
There definitely are. And I think part of the reason for me was that, you know, just knowing that I am an American citizen, I was always curious about what America is like. I never even been. I'm honestly, you know, besides sort of being born in the US, like I never actually came back once going to India. And I was really curious about what it's like. I only knew things from what my parents told me. And I really like the idea of a place where, you know, it's a meritocracy. You know, you can really, anyone can make it. Like all those types of ideas that you see in the movies, like really appeal to me. And that's what got me really excited about coming back to the US. I think the problem was I didn't really know like any better of which city, which college. Like if you told me like Boston, New York, like they all sounded the same to me. So I went with what my parents told me. They said Boston's great. It's the place you want to be. It's where students go most of the time. And I applied to probably tons of colleges. I would say maybe 20, 30 of them. Got into a lot of them, but ended up choosing Boston University because it felt like the right balance of like academics and sort of more holistic education.
So then talk to us about, you know, coming here to the US and really, you know, experiencing. You know, Boston is an incredible place, you know, a lot of young people, you know, great universities. So I'm sure that gave you kind of like the feel to be like, hey, you know, like maybe, you know, I want to get into this whole venture, you know, world, you know, eventually.
Totally. And I think like, you know, living in India, I was never exposed to, you know, some of the things that I got exposed to when I came to Boston University. But like culturally, like I'll give you an example, right? When I joined BU, it was 2008, like Obama had just gotten elected, right? I think there was like celebrations happening on the street. There was like the type of energy of like, wow, like anyone can come here, anyone can make it, right? Which got me really excited. And it kind of gave me a new perspective of like, it's not just about, you know, writing the code. and programming and making something, but how do you go beyond that? How do you like sell this to people? How do you like, you know, grow your user base, make something that people want to share with other people, right? And that's part of what I got to learn actually through that process.
So then talk to us about getting into, for example, with Snapchat, because that was a pivotal, you know, moment, you know, and the segue before you became a founder. So how was that journey with Snapchat for you?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, I was always interested in machine learning. It's something I studied at Boston University as well, and did a bunch of work at many different companies along the way, many startups and stuff, around like machine learning infrastructure and different types of like machine learning training and inference and things like that. And Snapchat was exciting to me because they were one of the first companies that was doing things with, you know, video and images that weren't being done before. Like a lot of the machine learning at the time was for things like, oh, like let's look at like a sales lead and figure out whether it's like a high likelihood to convert or a low likelihood to convert, right? Like, which is interesting. It's like, it's an interesting problem. But Snapchat was doing stuff like, hey, like let's morph the face and make it look like older or younger person, right? You know, it's just completely different. And it's more like a consumer sort of like anybody can look at that and appreciate that. I think the sales lead stuff is cool, but like probably the average person would be like, I don't know what you do with that exactly. And so that's really what got me excited. When I joined Snap, it was 2016. So it was just before the IPO, but the energy was as if it was like a brand new startup. Like if you look at, you know, how they were operating at the time, wow, it was just like truly, you know, as if it was a 1 or 2 year old startup, basically. Like everything was very do it yourself. The energy was very much like innovation first, right? Like it wasn't even like at the stage where people were thinking about maintenance and like sort of like protecting the turf that they've built out essentially, but really more like let's build something new, something amazing. And that was always like kind of, you know, the drive of the company basically at that time. And so, yeah, that's what got me really excited about Snapchat. So that also was how I ended up moving to New York at that time.
So then let's talk about you know, eventually thinking, hey, you know, like maybe it makes sense for me to really do something about this and start a company of my own, which happened eventually in February 2021.
Yeah, I mean, that was a whole journey because like at Snapchat, I had a whole transition that kind of happened through, you know, I joined as an engineer, you know, built a bunch of different products. And through the process of being at Snapchat, you know, and being an early company, at some point, I got, you know, a chance to meet the CEO there, you know, and he liked some of the work that I was doing, which got me involved in their design team, which was a team of people really thinking about innovation and how to develop new products at Snapchat. And that got me really excited too. So thinking about how we can put together design and engineering to like focus on innovation and building new products was one of my main goals in the last 2 years that I was there at Snapchat. So I built out that team and our focus was developing new products, figuring out whether they work or not, and finding that product market fit, right? And so we were able to develop, you know, dozens and dozens of these different products and prototypes that we would test and try to find product market fit in different areas that Snapchat would want to expand into. Over the course of this, like many things were playing out, right? At the same time, like TikTok as a platform was taking off 2019, right? For the first time, people were just like, you will see, I think people were logging into TikTok at that time and it was just a bunch of people dancing. And people were like, what is this? Like, is this a joke? Like, is this a real platform? This is just a fad. But the reality was that there was something deeper happening underneath all the dancing. Like people were also telling stories, talking, you know, sharing ideas. And it was kind of becoming the town square in a way that had never been possible before, right? Where like personality actually comes through, right? It's not just about text written on like a text only sort of platform like Reddit or Twitter or something like that, right? But for the first time, you could see the person, you could see like, oh, I understand that what type of person this is. Like I can relate to this person based on how they're talking and who they are, right? And that was kind of transformational, right? Like, I think people weren't realizing it at that time. And I think Snapchat saw that, you know, Snapchat was early to the short video game in a way. It's not the same type as TikTok, but people were recording videos and sending them to each other on Snapchat way earlier than TikTok came along. But TikTok kind of pioneered that, you know, public sort of sharing of these types of short videos. And kind of the entertainment angle to them almost, right? So that's some of the stuff that we were seeing at the time. And I was actually working at Snapchat on developing Spotlight, which was like their response product, essentially, to TikTok. And thinking about like what the advantages that TikTok had at that time were pretty significant, and like how Snapchat differentiates and builds something unique in that space, right? Without directly competing with something like TikTok that's growing very rapidly. So that was some of the stuff that I was working on. And as part of that, I was able to learn a lot about like the video space and kind of how it's evolving, and seeing that, you know, video is, you know, at that time was one of the fastest growing mediums. And if you were looking at like metrics, like Snapchat internally, I'll tell you, was, you know, TikTok was running ads actually on Snapchat to acquire users. So they were running probably $100 million a month or something like that. So a very large number, right? And there was concern of like, is this cannibalizing like Snapchat, right? Is this like eating up user engagement from Snapchat? And there were tests run to make sure that that wasn't the case. And in the short term, it wasn't. But if you look at the long run, it was eating up everything. Like essentially, it was eating up not just all the other social media platforms, but anything else that people do during the day, right? It was that engaging. It was that like almost addicting to an extent, right? And I think through that process, how I was able to learn about like the growth of this new content type, which were, you know, we started calling talking videos, right? Videos where people are talking and they're telling stories, they're sharing ideas, whatever it might be. And that's kind of what got me excited about the idea of like a company that's focused purely on that. And that's how Captions Earth came to be.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I guess for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Captions? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so we had a bit of a story of how we got to it, but today the business model is purely subscription. So we're a consumer subscription business. We mostly cater to like consumers, prosumers. We have some enterprise customers as well, but our bread and butter is sort of the long tail consumer.
What was that moment where you guys were like, I think that we're into something here, when you hit the product market fit?
Yeah, it was a process for sure. So like when we started the company, you know, we were thinking maybe we want to make a social network. So we were excited about the talking video idea, but we were thinking, okay, maybe we want to make actually something where you can share talking videos and where you can like respond to them. It's actually more of a network situation. And we thought maybe, yeah, since it's kind of a marketplace, we should start with the, you know, creation side. And then once we have creation sort of figured out, we can get consumption or distribution after that. But it kind of didn't work out that way. Like, I think the creation really hit it off. Like, the moment we launched the app, it was an instant hit, essentially. But as we were trying to build the consumption side, it turned out to be much harder than we had expected. And I think over the course of trying to figure that out, we got distracted. We were building other apps, various different types of apps. And, you know, it can be like a pretty difficult process because, like, if you think about like all the things in life that are challenging, you know, the normal things that we do, I'm not even talking about the abnormal, but like something like running a marathon or like learning a language or something like that, right? You kind of have a very clear, you know, end state that you can get to. So for example, you know, I'm learning a language, but I can say three sentences now or something like that, right? I can understand what people are saying every once in a while. And as I practice more, I get better and better. I can see the progress. Similarly, with running a marathon, like today I'm running 2 miles, tomorrow I'm running 3 miles, right? And you can see the progress happening. I think the problem with product market fit is that it's one of those things that you don't ever make any progress on until you do. So you can spend 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years doing it and not be any closer than you were when you started. And I think that's what makes it like one of the most draining, one of the most difficult types of problems to solve, because you don't see progress until you do. And sometimes you look at other people and say, hey, they spent 1 day on it and it worked, right? And there's nothing special about what they did. They were just lucky or, you know, somehow, you know, hit the right thing at the right time. And then you might spend 5 years on it and be no closer than on day one, right? And I think that's like one of the hardest things about it. But I think that's why keeping that mindset of like, you're not doing it to achieve product market fit. You're doing it to build great product and to get something amazing in front of customers and getting the joy and enjoying that journey, I think is really important, right? And at the end of the day, limited runway, limited time, taking as many shots as possible, not getting tied down to like one idea, being able to change the idea, think about like what more we could do. And that's what we were spending our time doing that entire first year, right? We were kind of evolving captions from what it was and seeing where we can find the product market fit. But eventually what happened was we did find product market fit in a slightly different product. It was actually a photo sharing product. And we were thinking about at that time, should we shut down captions? Because it was costing us money. It was costing about $10,000 a month. And we were thinking, let's shut it down so we don't have to spend this extra $10,000 a month. And what ended up happening was I remember going back and I was going to delete the captions project, essentially. And I thought, like, it just felt wrong when I was just about to do it, of just for the sake of, like, we put in so much work into this, I don't want to, like, I want to keep it around, I just want to delete it. And I had an idea of, like, okay, instead of deleting it, I'll just throw a paywall on the front of it to just, like, throw $10 a month. Just, like, you can't even open the application without first paying. The worst user experience, you know? And that way, if no one pays for it, it's essentially shut down. But if people pay for it, then it's not costing us anything because they're paying for themselves. So I built that in 2 or 3 hours, put it on the application, and then we forgot about it. And then we came back 6 months later, I was checking my bank account, and there was $500,000 in there, which was all actually coming from captions. And that was the moment where we thought, wow, we have to make a decision of what we want to work on because this thing is actually working. The reason I hadn't checked it is because it was on my personal account and I wasn't checking that, you know. And the company account was the new product we're working on. So we thought about it for a couple of weeks and we decided to go with captions because we were really excited about, like, it aligned much better with the original vision of what we were trying to do. And we're really excited about the video space and the AI space, which is exactly where captions lands, right? And it turned out to be the right bet because not maybe 6 to 8 months after that, GPT came out and sort of the AI revolution began, which just immediately shortened what we thought would be like a 10-year roadmap into a 2-year roadmap in like a blink of an eye. And I think that was just pure luck, obviously. But the timing turned out to be perfect.
So then, I guess, you know, in this case, you know, you guys have raised $100 million. So how has it been to going through the journey of raising money?
Yeah, I think, honestly, parts of it, we got lucky at the right times. I think parts of it is, you know, building the right network from the beginning. It's not something I was actively doing, but it kind of happened behind the scenes. I think some of the things that helped me, especially in the beginning, like in the first round, the seed round, you know, we were able to raise money in the seed round, I think mainly because the timing was right. Again, it was 2021. So the market was a little bit looser in terms of like the ability to raise money. People were kind of, you know, more open. It was a zero interest rate situation happening. So people were more open to just like doing rounds without too much, you know, to show. Not that that's what we were trying to do. We had a product to show. And I do recommend it. I think like having a product to show is like probably fundamental. Without that, like it's hard for someone, especially a VC, to be able to tell like, is this person all talk or can they actually do something, right? And I think that helped us quite a bit. But the reality is what helped us the most is over the years, I just kept in touch with every company, the people that I worked with, the CEOs and executives of those companies, and just made a good impression of those people and kept in touch with them, who ended up being great references for me, right? And pulling them in to be, you know, jump on a call and kind of, you know, just give me a reference on a VC I'm talking to, who can talk to them and ask questions and understand like who I am, actually made quite a big of a difference. And I think like for seed investors, a lot of times they're betting on the person, right? So the more signal they can get on like who this person is and how do they work, how they operate, right? The better it is. I think one of the most helpful was Snap's co-founder also kind of jumped on a call for me. And I think that probably made the biggest difference, especially in the beginning. But all that was just a matter of like years and years of relationship building and delivering, you know, great results and trying, you know, trying my best to like impress people and make sure that I'm doing my part as well as I can, right? And I think that that played a big role. So I think besides that, probably having a product, having something you can show demonstrably, you know, I think those things played a big role as well. I think throughout after that, it gets more and more complicated because, you know, as you know, there's just many more variables involved. Obviously, the success of the product and stuff is pretty significant factor in being able to raise additional rounds. But a lot of it also comes down to being able to tell a great story. I think there has to be a decision that needs to be made at some point is like, where is the end state of this company, right? Like, how, what is the massive outcome, right? Because for a VC-backed company, you have to be able to see a vision which is transformative, right? Like almost like societal transformation, right? And if that vision is invisible, you're going to have a hard time raising money because people need to be able to be inspired. I think a lot of times people think of like fundraising as like asking for permission from somebody, but it's actually finding people to join you along a journey, right? Like it's the same as recruiting. It's exactly like hiring employees, right? Where you have to inspire someone to be able to see a vision that maybe nobody else believes, but and sounds crazy today, but may become a reality and you have conviction in, right? Same for an employee and same for an investor, right? If you can get them to see that vision, they will come along the journey with you, right? And at the end of the day, you know, everybody who's involved with the company, like whether it's a customer, whether it's a VC or an investor, right? Whether it's an employee, you know, whoever it might be, they're all making a bet on this big idea, right? They're all along for this journey. And yeah, they're helping them see that end vision is like really fundamental.
Now, imagine, you know, obviously these investors, they invest in, and obviously the employees that you have too, as well as customers, they really go for the vision, right? And the future that you're living into. So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Gaurav, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Captions is fully realized, what does that world look like?
So the way I see it, you know, we're in the AI video space. I think the crazy sort of future that we are imagining is, you know, a world in which video is just generated by default, right? Like whether you're making a podcast or whether you're making TikTok videos, whether you're making ads, movies, you know, whether you're making educational content, sales, marketing content, whatever it is, like the combined value of all this, like is massive, right? Like all of that by default, people think, oh, of course we would generate it. That's how we would do it. That's the normal way to do it. And maybe some people for fun, sometimes like record videos because they're cool or something like that, right? Or maybe they like buy records and record videos or I don't know. But I think generally, we're imagining a world in which video generation is the norm, right? And what does that world look like? So for us, like that is the transformational change on top of which we're trying to build a company. Like, where do we land in that world? Like, in that world, we're a full stack AI company. Like, we build foundation models and we build the user software that actually serves how you create videos, right?
I love it. Now, we're talking about the future here. I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. So imagine I was to bring you back in time, okay? You know, we're talking about 2021, early 2021, when you're thinking about building something of your own. And you have the opportunity of having a chat with your younger self and being able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think my main advice would be that it actually, contrary to popular belief, it does help to work in the industry for a while before starting a company. I think it's easy to look at like the legendary companies like, you know, Facebook and things like that, and the founders were like 20 years old, 18 years old, 19 years old, and think that that is a norm and they should just jump into it immediately. And yes, that can work sometimes, right? But I think the reality is that the more you can refine your skill set of like understanding how does a company actually work, have a generalist mindset of, you know, not just going specific into one thing, but understanding different parts of the company, right? Like, how does engineering work? How does data science work? How does marketing work? How does sales work, right? Really building out that knowledge, it actually is a big helper, especially when the company starts to work. You're able to just, you know, use your knowledge and your experience to actually drive the company in the right direction right away. You don't have to do the learning on the fly. And I think that is a major differentiator. One thing that you'll notice is about those companies where the founders are like 18, 19 years old and it works out, I think most of the time the product market fit is so strong in those companies by chance or by design that no matter how many wrong decisions are made, the company can't be stopped. Like, it just is an unstoppable force, right? And that's a lot of that tends to be luck. But for most companies, like, that's not the case, right? You can't actually do a lot of wrong by making wrong decisions. And so having that experience, I think, actually does count a lot. And it's something I thought about a lot because I was always thinking about, like, is this the right time to start a company? Is this the right time? Do I have enough experience yet? And I feel like I actually got the perfect amount of experience. Like, I was very happy with where I landed.
So, Gaurav, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, I mean, LinkedIn, I think, probably is where I'm most active. X as well. Definitely present there as well.
Amazing. Well, Gaurav, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Awesome. Great to be here. Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.